Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and this week I'm looking for the best book called A Christmas Carol.
My name is Joe Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher, Nick, as you know. And Nick, if you're looking for the best book named A Christmas Carol and you want a spooky book about ghosts, I have just fantastic news for you. There's a book that fits both of those criteria. It Love is called it. A Christmas Carol. It is by Charles Dickens. It was faithfully adapted by Jim Henson in A Muppet Christmas Carol, which I assume we'll be talking extensively about today. And Nick, I really think you should read it. It's pretty good.
That's a good Venn diagram you built.
Hello? Welcome Hello. To You Don't Know Lit. Hello. I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher, as you don't know. And today, Nick, if you're looking for a book entitled A Christmas Carol, I have the novelization of Brian Henson's Muppet Christmas Carol entitled A Christmas Carol, because Marley was dead to begin with.
Oh, Nick, Marley was dead to begin with.
Happy spooky season, everybody.
It's back.
It's back. From
the grave.
It's back.
Ooh. Yeah, but like put some bells over that, some sleigh bells over that.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
I think the premise is generally pretty confusing already, but let's just explain this particular episode premise a little bit more. On our last spooktacular episode, which of course was on Halloween, we did discover that ghost stories were a Christmas tradition. Yes. And so welcome everybody to Spooktacular 2, A Christmas Carol. Joe, you brought this revelation to us. Tell us about it. Bring us back, Joe.
Yeah. So, when I was reading The Turn of the Screw by Henry James, the framing device of that was that people were sitting around on Christmas Eve, a bunch of friends, telling ghost stories. And I thought, that's weird. I don't ever tell ghost stories on Christmas Eve. And then I remembered the song, It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year, in which they say there will be tales of the glories and scary ghost stories of Christmases long, long ago, or something along those lines. And I thought,
yada, yada.
That's bizarre. That's two mentions of ghost stories related to Christmas. And then talking to Ian,
and then what happened,
during the podcast, we put together like, wait a second, A Christmas Carol is a ghost story on Christmas. So, Nick, we started looking into it. We put our best men on it. We got down in the lab, not to steal Ian's
men.
Bit. Yep. But we put our best men on it. And sure enough, telling ghost stories at Christmas was a thing. It was especially a Victorian thing, which is just fantastic for Charles Dickens. But, and we may get into this later, it might be really old, like predates Christ old, like thousands of years.
That's extremely confusing. I have so many questions now.
Time traveling ghost storytellers. That's what it
Christmas is. Celebrations predate Christ. Are we breaking this story now?
Nick, I have so much to say about this. I might not talk about Charles Dickens at all this episode. I might just talk about Christmas traditions.
I can tell you something about Charles Dickens and Christmas stories.
Yes, Ian, you in the back with your hand up.
You're on the right podcast, Ian.
Good.
I think we're ready.
Dickens tried to capitalize on the success of Christmas Carol because, spoiler, it was very successful. And he wrote four other novellas, which are kind of doing the same sort of spooky Christmassy thing. And apparently they were also very popular, but panned by the critics. The critics hated them. So,
and they all came out after A Christmas Carol?
No, they came out before the birth of Christ.
BC or CC?
They came out
BCC.
BCC before Christmas Carol?
Yes.
Guys,
when you send an email, folks, and it says BCC in the line,
Oh, this is
that doesn't
important.
Mean blind courtesy copy. Blind courtesy? Carbon copy. That means before Christmas Carol, you're sending that back in time.
It doesn't mean it doesn't mean blind courtesy copy. It doesn't mean blind carbon copy. It means
before
BCC,
Christmas Carol.
Before Christmas Carol. Yeah.
I've never heard it called a courtesy copy before.
That's because that's not what it's called. It's not called that ever by anybody. You literally heard it here first.
and probably last.
Yeah, and last. So before we really unwrap this gift, let's just pause on that one. And then
pause 10 seconds for station identification.
Let's hear about what this book is in 30 seconds or less, hopefully. Less. So maybe you each want to take 15 seconds?
Sure.
No.
Sure.
I wrote a sonnet. I wrote a sonnet. I thought because it's...
Is it 15 seconds?
It's not, unless I read it really fast.
Okay. I think if Ian wrote a sonnet, he gets to go over 15 seconds.
I mean, I usually do a rap, but it seemed disrespectful to be so anachronistic. So it is a sonnet about the plot of this story.
All right. Well, keep your mouth shut, Joe. We're ready, Ian. Are you going to sing it? What's a sonnet? Or is this a poem?
Oh, my goodness.
Neck.
Well, all right,
neck.
As you remember,
I'm ready. Oh, no.
Excuse me, teacher.
We talked about this. A sonnet involves three quatrains with rhyme schemes.
Oh,
alternate rhyme
okay.
schemes.
Gotcha.
A couplet at the end, which is a twist.
Ian, we're ready. We're ready for your sonnet.
Can you put a sick beat underneath this sonnet?
Absolutely.
Thank you. It's Christmas time, and Jacob Marley's dead. His partner Scrooge hates holidays so much. Their Clark Bob Cratchit's family is sad, because Tiny Tim, his son, must use a crutch. Three spirits come to Scrooge to teach lessons from past, to show the joy that Scrooge has missed. A present spirit shows him present fun, and silent future shows a deadly twist. These visions grip old Scrooge with bitter fear. He leaves his Scroogey ways. He gives his clerk time off. He buys a goose, spreads Yuletide cheer, and generally stops being such a jerk. In heeding well the words of spirits grim, Scrooge solves the social problems that plague him.
You have to have a cadence at the end here, yes. Crescendo.
Dun 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 dun. Love it.
How all sonnets end. Dun 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 dun.
I kind of tuned out because I was doing the music.
Yeah, that was a rookie move on your part, Nick, because now
yeah,
you
I wasn't listening
to Joe
at all.
Summarizing this plot.
Yeah, you're not going to know what's happening now, Nick.
Oh, no. Great. Super. Guys.
Yeah.
Where should we start? Who's the most passionate? Who wants to go first?
Well, I have prepared a game. And that might be the best spot to start.
It's always the best spot to start.
All right. Okay. This game. So I guess a little bit of Charles Dickens. Nick, maybe what do you know about Charles Dickens? Maybe start here.
Well, I'd like to start by naming this game.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yes.
Okay. Charles Dickfax or Dick.
Yeah, that's okay. That's pretty good because the game. Let me tell you the premise of the game and then maybe we can workshop it together here.
Fackins?
Charles Dickens is famous for character names, right? Like he has like these famous character names.
Okay.
So I have a game called Dickens Character, A City in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Ooh, good.
Or Weird Sex Thing. And
oh,
and
boy.
It's going to be three options, right? It's either going to be the name of a Charles Dickens character, the name of a Charles, the name of a city in the Upper Peninsula, or a Weird Sex Thing.
Okay. All right, so maybe, it's either a character, a city in the UP, or a sex thing. Okay, easy enough. And do we have a name for this game? A name game.
We could call it Dick Facts if you want.
It seems too crass. I don't like
it.
Pretty
crass.
Yeah, it's too much, and I regret saying it. Maybe Charles. We might have to stick with Dick Facts.
Well, we could do like What the Dickens. Like What the Dickens,
okay.
Which is, you know,
okay.
A little fun.
I don't mind that.
How do we insert the word fact into it?
Maybe it has to be Dick Facts, guys.
Charles Factons?
I got nothing. I'm staring at this name, and I can't put fact in it. It's just not fitting. Fackles Dickinson.
I run that by me one more time.
Fackles Dickinson.
Yep, that's the one.
Is it Fackles or Factals?
Fackles. Factals. Factals Dickinson.
All right, Fackles Dickinson.
Factals Dickinson. All right, I'm ready.
All right. I'm going to give you a name, and you are going to tell me if it is a Dickens character, a city in the Upper Peninsula, or a weird sex thing. Okay?
Okay. Super.
All right. Your first name is Sweetlepipe.
This is going to be tougher than I thought. I was really expecting, like, you know, something nasty. Okay. I'll go first, I guess. I'm going to say a city in the UP.
I think I'm also going to say a city in the UP.
Okay.
Really, really good guesses, but wrong. They are both. Sweetlepipe is, in fact, the name of a Charles Dickens character.
Are you serious?
Okay. All right.
Yeah. In what book?
See, I didn't take supplementary notes on this.
Oh,
I
no.
just went for silly names.
We just
I know.
Take your word for it?
I know.
Well, we do work off of the honor system here.
Sweetlepipe is, of course, Paul Sweetlepipe. Wait, no.
Here on Fackles Dickinson, we play on the honor system. So I believe you, Joe.
All right.
I believe you too, because I Googled it and you're right.
Paul Sweetlepipe is, of course, Mrs. Gimp's landlord in Martin Chuzzlewit. I think the novel that he published directly before A Christmas Carol, which was a commercial flop.
Right. It was one of his favorites, I think, and it did terribly.
Yeah. No, people did not like that.
Hey, do you have another one?
Yeah, I've got another name for you. This one, Nick. Pecksniff. Pecksniff.
Definitely a Dickens character.
Pecksniff. Sounds sexual. I'm going to say sex.
Yeah, sex is definitely what it sounds like. Ian, you're of course right here. Ian, you're familiar with this word probably.
No. I remember, I don't even remember which novel it's from. I just remember reading it and being like, that's a good name there, Charles.
Yeah, Pecksniff is a Dickens character. It's one of these names that has, it has kind of slipped into our language. Like, you could call somebody a Pecksniff, and there's a reasonable chance that, like, other people might know what you're talking about. It means a hypocrite. It's a Dickens character, right. And his name now is synonymous with hypocrite.
This is also from Martin Chuzzlewit.
Yeah, maybe it's just Martin Chuzzlewit. Yeah, Pecksniff. Oh, all right. I've got another one for you.
So I'm currently leading.
Mm-hmm. One to zero.
One to zero.
Pecksniffer.
Germfask. Germfask.
Germfask?
Can I ask how it's spelled?
Yes. Germfask. One word.
So exactly like it sounds. Okay, crap.
Yes.
City. Have all of them been characters so far?
The two that we've listed have been characters so far. This is the third.
All right, I'm going to go city.
I'm going to go weird sex thing.
Freak.
Yeah, it is a city in Upper Michigan. It is a civil township in Schoolcraft County, a population of 486. And
I'm a little disappointed that all of these haven't been weird sex things. I feel like I'm learning too much, been tricked into learning with the illusion that there would be weird sex things. And now
that's
I'm just
pretty
learning.
Much like 60% of what teaching is tricking students into learning. Normally not with weird sex things, but okay. Still tricking.
I hope not.
All right. I've just got one more for you guys. Master John Goodfellow.
If this isn't a character, it's got to be a sex thing.
I think it's a sex thing.
Gotta
yeah,
be a sex
thing.
It's
definitely a sex thing. From 1653. From 1653.
What?
It is a Ooh. Different name. For a penis. It's the different name for a penis. Master John Goodfellow.
One more time for me, nice and slow.
Yep. Master John Goodfellow.
Wow. Do you know the root of this nickname?
Yeah, I do. It is.
Tell us about your penis fact, Joe.
Sorry, I want you to guess.
Salivate over here.
From 1653, from the works of Rabelais. I'm not familiar with this. Francois Rabelais.
Rabelais. Mm. Yes.
He was notoriously kind of a saucy fellow.
Oh, real sausage boy. Is that what you said?
Nope. I said saucy fellow, not real sausage boy.
Sorry. Yeah, that's what
there
I said.
There is a scene in this book in which there is a quote that says, "Hold!" And he shows his long codpiece and he says, "This is Master John Goodfellow that asks for lodging," and with that would have embraced her. But she began to cry out, but not very loud.
I like that he asked for lodging.
Yikes.
Oh, I mean, this is terrible. The time has come, as many are calling it, the greatest year ever, to come to an end. And so I thought next week I'd share a little recap about what I've learned this year from my fellow podcasters. Time to give the people what they want. More of Nick. So next week.
Litheads, we've read your comments. We've heard your voice. Next week is a Nick-tacular.
Here I come.
Nick-tacular.
Nick-tacular.
It sounds like a nightmare.
It's going to have the pizzazz of the name Nicktacular mixed with the effort of a clip show. And so next
Which
week
from I'll an be- editing, editing standpoint is actually kind of a lot.
And so I will be bringing some thoughts on some of the books that you've recommended and also some fun surprises.
Oh, dear. Oh, boy.
Nothing makes me more nervous than when Nick says that he has a surprise for us. Nick, is there anything we have to do to prepare, either Ian and I or the Litheads? Is there anything we should do to prepare for next week's Nicktacular?
Yeah, bring a positive attitude. Mm-hmm. And be able to answer any of the random questions I ask you about
anything. About anything. This year. So this is a cumulative final for us, is what you're saying.
It's a cumulative final.
Oh no!
And I think for the Litheads, I think there'll be a new book. I think there'll be a new book to talk about.
Would you advise the Litheads to hold onto their butts?
I would. Thank you, Ian.
Well, I thought I would share with you guys, I want to bring a new segment to the show just to liven things up. Everyone's always talking about fun facts. Here's some facts. Here's some facts, fun facts.
Facts,
and
facts,
so on and
facts.
So forth.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought I would bring some facts that are not fun.
Oh.
Some useless, worthless facts, things that will probably you'll lose if you use these in trivia. And I just wanted to share these with you guys, and I really would love some feedback on them because I'm always trying to make my facts worse and less useful to any
dreadful facts. Are these Dickens facts or Christmas Carol facts or
unrelated
to
all of the above? I've got a nice little mix here. So the first one is if you reverse the beginning of the author's first and last name of this book, he is no longer named Charles Dickens, he is named Darles Chickens.
I don't know if that's a fact as much as
it is a fact.
I mean, you can't argue that is what happens.
Yeah. You know, if you do that name trick that you did with Charles Dickens or Darles Chickens with Norman Mailer, you get Mormon Nailer.
That's great.
Really good stuff, guys. These are really terrible facts. Truly living up to the name of the segment.
I got another one for you guys. Contrary to popular belief, the three spirits who visit Scrooge do not represent the three states of matter, solid, liquid, and gas. Instead, they represent the three ships which Christopher Columbus sailed to the New World, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria.
What? I didn't even get that one.
I don't get that one.
So there are three spirits, and everyone thinks that they represent like solid, liquid, and gas, the three states of matter. But in fact, Dickens wrote them probably, maybe, to represent the three ships in which Christopher Columbus sailed to the New World.
Dreadful facts.
We can't prove that that's not what happened.
We're going to have so many games and fun segments pretty soon that we're not going to have to talk about the book at all.
That's the goal.
Guys, I hate to do this, but I have a fun game for you.
Spooktacular 2 Extravaganza.
No, I don't have a game. I would like to learn about the book, though.
Well, tough. That's clearly not what Ian and I came prepared to do.
We have nothing.
Hey, guys, can we talk about the book? Please.
Okay, I guess maybe I'll start just by, Nick, I'll give you a brief overview of The Christmas Carol, and maybe that'll get us going.
That would be nice, because I didn't really listen to what Ian did earlier.
Yeah, right. So a Christmas Carol, Nick, is a story that you probably have heard before. You've probably seen some rendition of it, likely Muppet. And it is where Ebenezer Scrooge, this insular old miser, he's led this less than admirable life, and he's kind of fine with that. He's visited by an old boat business associate one night who shows up in chains, the chains that he wrought for himself, made of like dollar signs. And
now, is this a ghost, like, Joe?
It is a ghost of Jacob Marley.
Very spooky.
Very spooky. And you might think, like, okay, well, there's a ghost. That's good enough for our spooktacular episode. But Nick, I've got three more spirits coming your way.
All right. Oh, no.
Jacob Marley says, hey, look at me. This is what's going to happen to you, Scrooge, unless you shape up. By the way, you're going to be visited by these three spirits. The three spirits show up over the course of the night, which apparently represent the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. That's not going to make any sense if Ian's bit gets cut. So let me do another take of that. The three spirits show up.
Do a clean take.
The three spirits show up. Of course, those three spirits are the ghost of Christmas past, the ghost of Christmas present, and the ghost of Christmas yet to come. And in the most time-honored tradition of all time, things turn out just fine for the old rich white guy. Scrooge changes his ways and discovers the true meaning of Christmas.
Yep.
We will certainly come back to his white privilege, but Joe, yes. This is a pretty fucking weird story.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a weird story.
It's not biblical. Is it? Is it like,
no.
Are they supposed to be like angels?
So,
like, tell me about the book, because I've only seen the movies. In fact, I didn't even know it was a book until you guys brought it up. So,
yes,
I assume they didn't write the book after Jim Carrey's movie. So
it's a novelization,
right? The novelization.
He's on the cover of the book. So,
okay.
When did this come out? 1600s?
Okay. 1843.
Okay.
So this book came out December 19th, 1843. And I say December 19th because Dickens, I think this is cool, he started writing it in October of that year. Like his novel Chuzzlewit was a bit of a flop. He needed a little bit of money. He thought there might be some money to make in this whole Christmas thing, which was gaining more and more popularity at the time. So he cranked out a Christmas novella.
Can you please pronounce it correctly?
Oh God. He cranked out a Christmas novella.
Just gonna kill you.
I have few pleasures.
And it was super successful.
Life.
It was super successful. He released it on December 19th, and by Christmas Eve, he had sold out the entire first run, initial printing,
which was 6,000 copies.
Wow, it's pretty good.
6,000 copies in like 5 days, which is insane.
Back then, in the 1600s.
Back then for sure. Joe, did you run across the thing about the walking?
I don't think so. Go ahead.
Okay, so the story with him kind of cranking this out in like 6 weeks, basically. They're real poor. Him and his family. His wife was, I think, pregnant with or just given birth to their fifth child, and he needed money. And so he would take these long 15 to 20 mile walks around London at night in like late fall and early winter, writing this story in his head. And then he would come home and just write it down. And then he would do it again the next night. And just like, and then obviously he cranks it out really fast and it's super successful. But the image of Dickens, he's not just like sitting in his warm garret scrawling away. He's like prowling around London in the winter at night. And having been in London in winter, even today, it's kind of like it's a spooky place. Like there are tall buildings and there's like, you don't see the sun hardly at all, especially if it's nighttime. And
fog from
like,
what I hear.
Fog, the cold just gets in your bones. Oh, it's damp.
No.
And so like the atmosphere of kind of the ghostly vibes.
It's on par. So is this a good book? Is this worth reading? Do I want to read this around Christmas? What about our Jewish friends? Is this an insulting episode? What about our non-Christian friends?
So, Nick,
friends?
You asked a question.
Is this a good book or is this a good Christmas book?
So, Nick, I want to talk just for a second, I guess. And I don't want to derail us too far from Charles Dickens stuff. But,
I'm going to understand
where this... Well, I'm going to a little bit because I think this is so interesting.
Okay.
To understand where this novel is coming from, I have to talk to you, Nick, about... The War on Christmas. You've heard of this phrase before, the War on Christmas.
Absolutely not. What is it?
Okay, so the War on Christmas today is frequently lobbied by, I don't know, like right-wing columnists saying that like all these horrible liberals are trying to take Christ out of Christmas.
Ah, yes. Okay. I thought this might have been an older thing. No, this is a new
it
thing.
It is an older thing.
Oh, okay.
Charles back to 1653.
Yeah. So Charles Dickens was also writing this kind of in the tail end of a war on Christmas. Ian, you clearly know something about this. 1653, you want to tell us what happened?
Oh, I was making a joke about Rabelais, but you're talking about the Puritans, right?
Yeah, I'm talking about the Puritans.
Yeah. So basically there was a political and social and religious and ideological movement, primarily the one we would know it from would be England and America. And these are people who took sort of Christian doctrines and interpreted them in very kind of specific ways. And part of this involved holidays being framed as really, really bad. Because these folks valued, I mean, drawing on some of the stuff in Christian doctrine about, you know, the value of work and, you know, be diligent. They kind of took this to an extreme and said, well, if work is good and like being productive is good, therefore anything which takes you away from work, is a bad thing. And holidays are not Sunday. Sunday it's fine to not work, but on holidays, you probably ought to still be working. And so this kind of held sway for a while in England, and then for longer, definitely in
America. Is that
America.
Kind of represented by our main character?
Perhaps.
Like, you see the embodiment of that war on Christmas, Joe?
Well...
Is this what you were getting at slowly?
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about these holidays because
he keeps skirting my questions,
Nick's,
Ian. So
Nick's literary analysis is too fast for you, Joe.
Ian, Joe keeps skirting my very, very good questions. So I'm just making notes of them. So I'd like to come back to them.
Great.
So the Puritans really disliked Christmas.
Always
Nick,
wants
right?
to talk to me about the Puritans.
So at a certain point in these Puritan societies, both in England and America, at a certain point, celebrating Christmas was outlawed because Christmas was seen as this pagan holiday.
I love it.
And okay. Here's the thing. So when I talk about the war on Christmas, like the Puritans, they kind of have a point. Like they looked at Christmas and they said, hey, there's nothing Christian about this. So for example, many of the things that we associate with Christmas, mistletoe it goes all the way back to the Druids, these religious leaders in Celtic societies, where they would keep oak leaves into the winter for their magical and health giving properties. The Yule log, like this large log that we would burn at Christmas time, goes back to like Scandinavian Christmas well before the time of Christ, in which they would find the biggest log they could, light it on fire, and basically party until that fire went out 12 days later.
Of course.
Holly and ivy are evergreens that the Celts use to keep evil spirits at bay. The tree itself is like decorated with these symbols of life and the celebration of life, like these light, like these red apples and these solar objects like stars and lights, originated probably from like pagans in Germany. So our Christmas celebrations are full of these like very old, very non-Christian things. And the Puritans, Nick, they put their foot down.
So basically everybody's celebrating Christmas and they're saying this has nothing to do with the Bible.
That's exactly what's going on here. And here's the kicker. They were pretty successful.
Christmas really fell out of favor. It kind of fell out of fashion, might be the better way to say it, among the gentry, among the upper classes. And for years, it was kind of like this little holiday that poor people celebrated. So like when Ebenezer Scrooge is talking to Bob Cratchit and he says that the 25th of December is nothing more than an excuse for to pick a man's pocket once a year, like that wouldn't have seemed so Scroogey at the time. Like it was kind of this holiday for poor people.
Huh. A little bit more history here than I was expecting.
And now you can only celebrate Christmas well if you have a whole bunch of money and still go into debt.
Yeah.
Because it's all consumerist.
Yes. That's a good point, Ian.
Thank you.
Speaking so you're saying power. We've come a long way, Joe, and this is not an issue anymore.
Yeah, this is no longer an issue.
We've solved Puritanism.
We have solved Puritanism.
So, Joe, now that you've really set this up much better than I anticipated.
Hey, I didn't know it had so such. Surprised.
No, I didn't know it had such a backstory. I just thought it was this stupid Christmas book.
Well, okay, that's one of the things that I think makes this book like pretty cool, because when Charles Dickens wrote this, like Christmas is kind of on the upswing. It's like sometimes you'll hear Dickens called the man who invented Christmas. That's kind of bullshit, I think. Like I don't think he like
sure he didn't think, physically invent it,
right? But I do think he helped usher in like a renaissance of Christmas.
This book is super clever. It's written really like people know Dickens, Darrow's Chickens, for his heartwarming, heart-wrenching stories of like sadness or like this guy changes his ways. But he's also really good at being funny. And this book is actually really funny. It's genuinely witty, kind of throughout. And that's something that a lot of the movies don't capture so much. They really lean into the sort of pathos of it. So it's really cool to get a more textured bit of this story.
Okay, so blah, blah, blah. Everybody hates Christmas. Chickens is like, no, check this out.
Yeah, it's like, nah, guys, Christmas is cool.
I'm gonna make you love Christmas while simultaneously selling 6,000 copies and making shit tons of money. The real spirit of Christmas.
He didn't actually make that much money off of it.
Yeah.
No. What about in the long run?
No, well, kind of. Did so he ended up, he thought this was going to like make his fortune. He thought he was going to get like £1,000 out of it, which in that time was a lot, but he only cleared like a quarter of that. But yes, he thought he was going to make a lot of money off of it, and he did not make as much as he expected, which is a bummer for him.
That's always a bummer. What's this book about?
This book, Nick, it's literally exactly what you think it is. Like Ebenezer Scrooge is like this tight old man who has no spirit for Christmas. He is spooked. He is spooked by three spooks. They come and they show him the right way to live life. They show him scenes of like what he's lost but in his past by not celebrating Christmas. They show him like an old boss that he had that was just like this awesome boss that was really cool to work with. They show him his old girlfriend who they broke up because he was too interested in his business pursuits and like she kind of wasn't enough for him anymore. And then they show her with her like current husband and all their kids and grandkids and like this lovely wife life that they have together.
So Ian, Joe didn't answer my question. Is this a good book or a good Christmas book?
I think it's a good book. Honestly, like it's gotten
be
so
honest,
tied up.
Ian, be honest.
I am being honest. Okay. If you would let me finish, I would be very honest with you. I would say this is a good book. This is a good, like entertaining, enjoyable, pretty spooky book.
Is it more spooky than it is Christmassy?
Christmas thing. Well, I think it really starts off extremely spooky. And then kind of towards the middle, it becomes more Christmassy. But then the end, there's like a strong rally of the spook. And then it ends very Christmassy.
That was a pretty good play-by-play of the book.
I have another question before you answer any of the questions that I just asked.
Great.
Is this like the scene is Christmas time, but it's about something else? You know, when people say like Die Hard is a Christmas movie,
it is not.
Is this like the Die Hard of books?
It's not Gremlins.
No, I don't think so.
Home Alone.
it's set at Christmas and it's interested in Christmas, but I think it's a kind of a story which you can read any time of the year. And the reason for this is because the change that our central character undergoes. Ebenezer Scrooge goes from this really, really like tight, like mean, grouchy. I mean, like he's kind of like a Grinch, to mix our metaphors.
And, he's crabby.
And he goes from that. This just totally, he exudes this air of coldness. And he's super mean to everyone. And then over the course of this experience with these ghosts, he like learns how terrible he was and he changes. And I think that kind of that motif of redemption is a wonderful story any time of the year. And it's not just a Christmas, like, cause redemption is like redemption and people becoming better is a universal thing.
Now it's the end of the year. It's a wonderful time to reflect on. There's just so many things to be grateful for in 2020. What are the lessons that he learns and can we learn from them? At this beautiful time of the year.
Okay. So this is a year, Litheads and my fellow illustrious podcasters. This is a year when you may not be gathering. This is a year when you may not have seen close family for months. You might be facing the possibility of a Christmas without the gathering that is traditional for you. And you might be feeling a sense of loss. I think a lot of people are feeling a sense of loss. This is not a substitute for that. But this is a reminder that there are Christmases yet to come. This is a reminder that at some point in the future, it may look very different, but we will be able to gather. This is a reminder that the future that we can imagine is not the only future which is set in stone, and that there are possibilities for happy, warm, loud, overfilled, slightly tipsy Christmas gatherings in the future. Even if this upcoming Christmas is a lot different from what we're used to, there are Christmases future.
Or,
oh no,
this might be the best Christmas you ever have.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Who wants to read a quote? There's no losers. It's a Christmas episode.
All right. So Nick, this one comes to you from Ebenezer Scrooge's nephew, who, despite Scrooge's scrooginess, has always tried to put him in the Christmas spirit. He's kind of this irrepressible character throughout this. And he says, "But I'm sure I've always thought of Christmas time when it's come around, apart from the veneration due to its sacred name of origin, if anything belonging to it can be apart from that, as a good time. A kind, forgiving, charitable, pleasant time. The only time I know of in the long calendar of the year when men and women seem to know by consent to open their shut-up hearts freely and to think of people below them just as if they were really fellow passengers to the grave and not another race of creatures bound on other journeys. And therefore, Uncle, though it has never put a scrap of gold or silver in my pocket, I believe it has done me good. And will do me good, and I say, God bless it.
God bless us, everyone."
Oh, that's how I was going to end if you read the last quote. All right, Litheads, remember when your uncle's talking about the war on Christmas this year, that the Christians started it.